You have to pay, maybe.
Well, did you have a family when you moved on?
I have two, a son and a daughter.
How old were they?
Oh, I guess when they moved off, let's see, 36. The boy was 16 and the girl was about 10.
Oh, Lord. Good Lord. You must be 100 years old, Miss Eastman. When was that? When did you move? 1930?
Don't answer now. You're getting fixing to get your age pegged.
36?
Yeah.
Oh, you didn't move off the farm till 36.
Yeah.
Yeah.
36, I bought this place in the village.
Yeah.
There's a big shop that's 28 feet wide and 56 feet long. The shop down underneath it, all one big room and 10 feet ceiling. And then upstairs, the living quarters upstairs had, there was a... A plumbing shop, one thing and another, and the fellow lived up overhead. Mm-hmm. Well, then he got around and run off with another man's wife, and his,
golly.
I don't know what you'd call her, a widow or what, but she sold it to a bus company, a fellow that run the bus. He run the bus from the village into the city one way and the city the other way, see, and he was in the middle. When he first started in, everything went nice for him. Well, then he got buying big buses,
yeah.
And he went in debt for a bigger one. And the bus business went busted, and so did he.
In the 30s?
Yep.
That's before you got there?
Yep. And I was putting a water pipe line in, or replacing it. There was a spring up on the hill, and the water run down, and it come to that place and went up to the hotel. Well, the pipe got poor, and I was replacing the pipe. And I never liked to go across somebody's property, even if it was right in the roadway, without getting their permission to dig it up. So I stopped in to see him about digging it up, and well, he says, you'll have to go to the bank because, he says, I don't own it anymore. He says, I've lost it. And so I went down to the bank to see about digging across there, and of course they nailed me to sell me the place.
I'll be darned.
So I bought it and moved down there.
Well, now what you did, you see, what he did, he went from that little farming community into that, they had a factory there.
Yeah, then.
This morning, we wanted to get this stuff up here. I called them up down there, and they wouldn't pay a bit of attention to me. He called them up, and they brought it up here. And they had one man on the job. He says he couldn't leave and make a delivery. But see, he got it up here.
I told him to go hire this other fellow and send it up.
And it is.
But you see, the fellow that owns it down there now... Oh, he's a big, tall fella. He couldn't walk in that door, could he, Miss
Just
Eastman?
About.
And he got hands, you see, that look like palm leaves.
He's a great big Pollock. And boy, he'd take a 100-pound bag of stuff, you know, and take it right in one hand, pick it right up just like that.
All in the family. That's beautiful. I like it.
Are you Polish?
No, I know. That's what my father used to say. Oh. My father was always talking about the poleaxe, the kite, the niggers, and the... Well, that's something else in there. What was it?
Well, you know, this fella here, when they introduced me to him...
Dago.
They introduced me to him down there in the store, see, and they said he come from New York. Well, I said, what part of New York? Well, he says, Phoenix. Well, and I said, you were just about as far from Syracuse northeast as I was southwest from Syracuse. And where were you from up there? And I said, Munsville. Munsville, he says. God, my grandparents lived in Munsville.
Oh.
I said, what was their names? And he says, Creaser. I said, old John Creaser and the young John and Frank and Ted and the girl with Dorothy. Yeah, he says, they're my uncles and my aunt.
Oh, boy.
But I didn't know his mother, because she was the oldest one in the family, and she was married and had gone. See?
Oh, that's my small world, don't you?
So he goes down there, you see, and orders them around, is what happens, you see.
He gets it, whatever happened, he got it done.
Oh, I get it, you get it. And here, a couple of weeks ago, I lived down there. You know where the Trade Winds restaurant is?
Right straight down. You come by it.
Oh, did we? All right.
And, well, I lived right across the road from it. Right across the road, there's a little trailer court in there, see? And I live the first house right with the trailer court. There's just a trailer court between me and the 441 there. And there was a bunch of gypsies come in down there. Well, I was working up to McIntosh, and I started to go home that night, and I got down there. And, gee, the road was full of house trailers. And I turned to go up my way, and here was one right across. And the kids, you know, gee, they was all the way from babies on up. And the trailer court, there's eight openings for the septic tank sewage. Well, there were two trailers set in there, taking up two of them openings, so that left six of them for 23 trailers to look in. Well, gee, they run over to the restaurant and they flushed him so much over there that they filled him up with water, and the water wouldn't run away. He has drainage troubles anyway. And it goes up to the gas station just up the road there, and they flooded him out so he wouldn't let them have the key anymore. And the old gypsy woman, I don't know whether I'll tell you what she said or not. She says, son of a bitch, she says. And then he says she started right in chattering in Spanish. He says, I don't know what she said, but I know darn well it wasn't good. Well, he called the Board of Health, and they didn't pay no attention to him. And Barnard over at the restaurant, he called them, and they didn't pay no attention to him. And I was talking to Barnard. Barnard called up and wanted me to come over, and he wanted to know what he was going to do. He was flooded out over there. And he said, I said, well, call the Board of Health. Well, he says, I did, and they haven't done anything about it. Well, I said, I'm going home, and I'm going to call him. Well, I called him down there, and I got him on the phone. And I said, I know that we haven't got any law enforcement officers in Marin County anymore, but I did suppose we had a Board of Health down here that might do something. And he said, well, he said, I had a couple of calls, but I didn't think there was much to it. Well, I said, I think there's something to it. I said, when they go out to the back of the trailer and just scuff a little bit of a hole and squat on it. He said, what? And I said, you haven't got to believe me. You come up here and look. He says, I'll be there just as quick as my car can bring me. Well, I think he did all right, because in just about an hour, you'd laugh to seen him. There was when I got home that night there was a circle right around, and they was all sitting right around the circle, and this one fellow in the middle, I suppose he was probably the king of the bunch. And he was waving his hands, and they're going around there, and one thing and another. All at once they broke right up, and the fellas got in their trucks, and they started hooking right onto them trailers, and five of them pulled right out of there. And the next morning they all went. So sometimes you got to be kind of uppish to them fellas there if you get anything done.
Well, now, that's the same principle, you see, that we got this stone up here. Yeah.
So that's the old principle, the old political principle.
And he didn't, I heard him talking, and he didn't work him over. He didn't work him over, did he, Phil?
No, I know. That guy doing perfectly well, that if anything goes wrong with his plumbing, then he calls him.
Yeah.
He'll come.
How about that, Mr. Eastman?
Yeah?
You know, do you work for Rennick, any?
Yeah.
That's the old quid pro quo game, or mm-hmm. You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours.
Did you hear what he said? Say it again.
That's the old, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours.
Yeah,
you.
Oh,
no,
yeah.
Say it the other way.
The quid pro quo?
Yeah, tell him.
No.
Tell him.
You didn't.
He's using
he's putting
that,
me up to no good.
He's using that gypsy talk.
Yeah.
Gypsy talk.
What is that? Quid? What is it?
Yeah. Quid pro quo. And there's the three Latin words. You prove perfectly well what they mean.
Now, what about that? See?
Like weeny weedy weeky.
Yeah. You and Julius. Weeny weedy weeky. You've been talking to him.
No.
You've been reading the book.
You mean you had that in school too?
Well.
Oh, shit.
Oh, my.
I had another one in school. Ik was snake, thus soll es bedeuten, das ich so traurig bin. Ein Mirken aus alten Zeiten, das kommt mir nicht aus dem Sinn. Die Luft ist kühl, das dunkel, den Ruhig fließt der Rhein. Der Gipfel des Berges funkelt, den Abendsonnenschein.
Zweiten Strophe, bitte.
Hä?
Zweiten Strophe. Den Schiffer in kleinen Schiffe. That's the second verse. Well, did they have that in school? Did you learn? See, they taught German in schools in his time. And yeah. Since where I come from, too, my mother, it was the other language in the public school.
I had 2 years.
Cincinnati.
I had 2 years of German and two of Latin.
Mm-hmm. It was taught in public school along with English, the other language.
They taught 4 years of Latin in school there where I was, but I only
had... That's where I learned quid pro quo.
I had 2 years of Latin, two of German.
Well, do you keep it up, Mr. Eastman? Do you still read them?
Well, what do you mean if you keep it
up?
You can get away with that very neatly in Bremerhaven. It sounds a little like
once in a while, I get in where there's a bunch of Germans, and if I pay off with strict attention,
yeah.
I can tell what they're talking about, see?
Now, you know, don't you think that's remarkable that you remember something like that all those years?
There was an old German fella up home there that... He used to say, he says, you can't say Sprechen. He says, your tongue is too long. He says, the Shermans, he says, they got short tongues, he says.
That's right.
Sure. Mr. Eastman, I'm not interested in that. What I'm interested is in this. Where did you learn so goddamn much? You see, you can do electrical and you can do all that milk stuff and...
Milk?
Oh, he worked in the milk. He worked in everything in the milk.
I've been through the milk business and everything, but the delivery of it.
Yeah.
Now, how do you suppose you learned?
I was maintenance man for probably, 15 years, taking care of 5 milk stations.
Yeah.
And I went through everything from taking in raw milk to pasteurizing it to making cheese and butter. And
wow.
Powdered milk.
Kept that stuff going.
I set it up and kept it going.
Yeah.
They'd send up a bunch of stuff from New York, and I'd go somewhere else and look at another plant that had that kind of machinery in and come back and set it up.
Now, you see?
Automatic milking?
Huh?
There's automatic milker?
Yes, everything.
Yeah.
Well,
God Almighty, I don't see how in the world you did it. Now, you didn't, nobody told you.
Just went down and looked at them and come back and set them up. they sent them up there at the same time. Well, I had three men working for me besides myself, and I set that one up to Munnsville there and had it all ready to run. And the field man come up and he says, I says to him, he says, "How you coming?" I says, "It's all ready to start tomorrow morning." He said, "What do you mean?" Oh, I said, "It's all ready to run." I said, "And I've had it running." Said, "You don't mean that." I said, "You come out here and look." And we went out in the other part of the building there, and I took and opened up the steam valve and pushed up the starter lever, and everything took right off. He stood there and he looked. Why, he says, over at that other plant, he says, "They got seven men working over there." He said, "And they haven't got it half ready." He says, "Will you go over there and finish that job up?" "No," I says, "I don't want to get mixed up in that deal." I says, "He's a friend of mine, and I don't want to go over there and make enemies with him." He said, "Will you ride over there with me?" "Oh, yes, I'll ride over with you there and look at it." And he got over there, and he told this other guy, he says, "I'm going to bring this fellow over here to take charge of putting up this plant and getting this running order." He says, "Now," he says, "he got three men besides himself, and you've got seven." He says, "They've got that plant running over there, and you ain't even just getting started." And, well, I says to this other fellow, I said, "I don't want to come over here and butt in on you and make any hard feelings." Well, he said, "If you know so doggone much about starting that thing up," he says, "you come right ahead." He says, "There's a lot of that blueprints," he says, "that we can't get head nor tail to." Well, I said, "If that's the way you feel about it, I'll come over and get this thing running." So I went over there, and in about 3 days, we had it running again. Of course, I had a full force of men, my men and his men, too. We just got it going right over there. But I've always been in on the maintenance of that.
How's that, Don? How do you make powdered milk? I always wanted to ask somebody that knew how.
How do you make powdered milk?
Yeah.
Well, sir, I'll tell you.
I'd like to know, too.
Wouldn't you?
Huh?
Yeah. How?
They have these.
I like it.
This machine has two big round cylinders. See, that are hollow. They're steel cylinders that are hollow. And they run right against one another, right tight. Just like this here, running them right together, just like that, see? And here's a wooden end on here that pushes right tight against them to seal them tight, see? And your milk runs right in here. Your milk comes and runs right in here, see? And these are hot. And these run right around this way. And that milk just sticks right on. See?
To the hot cylinder.
The hot cylinder, the milk sticks right on. On this other side, there's a knife.
Scrapes it
off. It sits right on there, that just shaves that right off.
How about that?
See? Well, I've seen that come off in there in a sheet, just like a sheet of paper, and it might run 500-600 feet before it'll break.
What draws the steam off from the milk?
Huh?
You got to have a pretty strong, take the steam out.
Well, the steam comes right straight through here, see, and your steam comes into these cylinders.
No, I meant you're going to have a lot of steam from that milk evaporating.
Oh, well, that just comes off and just goes off there, and had ventilators up there that drawed it off. But that's the way the
well,
print.
I'll be
it
hanged.
Comes right off,
I've never done that.
And that drops right off and drops right into a trough. And it has a worm here that draws that right straight along, see, and it breaks it all up. Well, then it goes into a little hammer mill, see, and then them hammers come right around. They're all loose on there, and as they come around, they drive that powdered milk right through a sieve, see, and that's what regulates the size of it, see. Well, then from there, they bag it up, and it goes.
It's whole milk now you're talking about.
Well, you can have whole milk or skim milk.
Whatever
don't make
they
any
put
difference.
In it.
They used to make skim milk there.
I would think so.
Powdered skim milk.
I was wondering about the...
Or powdered whole milk. Don't make any difference.
How high butterfat content could you have before you ran into trouble with that? That butterfat part of the milk hitting that thing and catch it on
well,
fire?
Well, it wouldn't catch on fire.
Or smoke it would burn, wouldn't it?
Not too much. It wouldn't burn. Once in a while, I've seen it scorch on the sides here. See, and then you got to shut your steam down. But most of your milk runs well around from 4 or 5 to 5%.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mr. Eastman, what did old man Creaser do?
He worked in the foundry, a molder.
Sam.
Was that a pretty skilled job?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it was a good job.
Yes, sir.
They used to make big money, those molders did, because they run a lot of chances of getting burnt, you know. Once in a while, some fellow would get burnt to beat all of that red hot iron.
Did you ever see them make those molds, those sand molds?
Well, they got to get close to it.
They have a regular molder shoe. It's all solid up here and solid in the back, and then it's got a webbing in the side. See? So that if they get that red hot iron on there, you see, they can kick it off in a hurry.
Yes. Oh.
See, they can kick that shoe right off.
That burn.
They're made a good deal. I've seen bedroom slippers made a good deal like that, see, but your molder shoes are made out of heavy, heavy leather, see.
Check with them, please.
Yeah, boy.
Mr. Eastman, let me tell you, that foundry at that time was just a little slow, or not?
No, they were right up to snuff at the time they was running.
Yeah.
Of course, at that time, you know, it was all horse-drawn farm machinery. You didn't have the tractors like you got today.
No. And they used a little water power?
Yeah. That's the reason they were located in the village down there, see?
Yeah.
They were down from the railroad. They were a half a mile away from the railroad, and they had to draw everything one way and the other, see?
But the business of... Now, they had to melt all that iron, didn't they?
Yeah, well, sure. They're what they call the kill.
Yeah.
They took them in the bottom of it, you know. They started just with shavings and kindling wood and one thing and another, and then they had this coke. You know what coke is? Well, they dumped that coke in there, and then most of that, you know, was that big coarse stuff. See,
mm-hmm.
It'd be like just that, like your arm here, you know, and you used to card it right up. They take and throw a layer of coke in there and then a layer of iron. See? Same as they might put in a layer of coke and a layer of pig iron, and then a layer of coke and then a layer of secondhand iron in there. See? It depended on what they was going to use it for. See how much new iron they had to have and how much old iron they could use in it.
Yeah.
And they'd melt it all up in there. And then down in the bottom of that, you know, they had this, there's a hole about that big around. And they had what they called the plug. It was made out of clay, wet clay, see? And then they had this ramrod, and it had kind of a half hole in it, see? And they put that clay right in there, you know, and have it wet, see? And it would be kind of loose, so they'd ram it right into that hole, see? And the heat would bake it right in there. Then they'd just take and pull their ramrod back and it would stay right there.
Yeah.
See? Well, then when they wanted more iron out of there, they had a big, like a great big bit, wood bit, you know, mm-hmm. See, with a handle on it. They'd push that right up there and turn it, you know, and yank it out and did it. That plug would come right out and the iron would run out there and they'd catch it in these buckets. And them buckets had two handles on each side, see? There'd be one man on one side and one on the other, and they'd just take and pick it up, and the buckets had a little lip on it, and they'd go over and pour it right in the molds, just as they wanted it there.
Now, that's when they would kick off them shoes.
Yeah. If the thing got away, like a mold broke, and it all ran down on you.
Yeah.
Yeah, if they got in that hot iron on them, you know, they could kick them shoes off.
When I was a kid, I used to watch them do that. There was a foundry down the street from where we were.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. They made engine parts or something.
Down where?
In Cincinnati. There was a foundry down the street. And I remember those guys carrying that and wouldn't do that anymore. Nobody towed anything like that. And all that heat, carrying those big ladles.
That's right. Hot.
Hot
stuff, too.
Oh,
It's heavy and hot.
Whew.
Well, about 15 miles.
Summer they worked in those things.
About 15 miles from where I lived, they had a big iron mine. See,
that's
they'd bring
right.
That,
that's up there around the
they'd bring that ore out, you know, and they'd heat it up, and that the slag what they call the slag out of it, looked just like these honeycomb that the bees have, see, when you take and melt the iron out of it, it'd be all full of holes, that stone would, see. Well, then they'd, when they poured off there, they had these squares in the floor, in the sand, you know, and they took and started pouring in, and that iron would run right down, and run down this one here, and cross into this one, over on another, and keep it running, see, it filled all of them squares up.
Yeah.
Well, then when the iron, when it cooled off a little bit, the fellow would go right along with a big sledge, and they just hit that, you know, and they'd break right off, and then pigs, what they call pigs, they'd be about that big around and about that long. And they'd weigh from 100 and a quarter, 150 pounds. Some of them fellows would grunt the beat all to pick that stuff up.
Oh, you know they would.
Yeah?
Yes. Now, you were doing well out there on the... What'd your wife know about farming, Miss Eastman?
Well, that was her folks' farm that I was on.
That's what she knew about it.
Oh, is that right?
Of course, I was brought up on a farm before that.
Yeah.
I thought she probably knew about the same amount that the wife of the plumber did that lost the business.
Yeah. Well, did she know a little bit, or just...
Well, I'll tell you just what there was about it. Every cow that had a calf, you'd got to raise the calf, no matter whether the cow was any good or not.
Oh.
And I didn't believe in that. I wanted to raise the calves from cows that was good and raise good calves.
Yeah.
And raise good cows. But she, well, now maybe that calf will be better than her mother.
Yes.
That was the idea that she had, you know, see?
Yeah.
That's an awful long investment. And a maybe.
Oh, it is.
And I always raised good calves, and I fed them good, and I raised them good, and it pays.
Oh, you raised your own dairy calves.
Sure.
But nobody does that anymore.
Well, somebody's got to.
Yeah.
Yeah, but back in those days, most people did.
Now, I saw a cow yesterday in a truck come down there to the restaurant, and she had a baby calf with her.
Yeah.
Well, now, she just come from the auction up there to Gainesville, and I bet you $10 they sold her for being a New Milk's cow with that calf, and I know darn well that that wasn't her calf, and that she wasn't a New Milk's cow.
Do you know the person that had it?
Huh?
Do you know the people that had it?
No.
Okay.
Is that right?
Well, I can tell from the looks of that cow that she wasn't no New Milk's cow.
Yeah.
But I'll bet you the way that they was together there, that I've seen that done.
Yeah.
And next to horse trading,
yeah, I've seen it done.
Yeah. Is that right? Mr. Eastman, now let me tell you. Tell him about them Morgans, how they pull.
The Morgans?
Yes.
I had a little pair of Morgans. One of them weighed 1,200 and the other 1,225. And there wasn't no team ever lived that weighed a ton apiece that could take the evener away from them. I've seen them little devils get right down and push until their bellies wouldn't be that far off in the ground, and they'd just be right there just a-pushing. And I'll tell you something else, and I never told you I don't believe this. I had a dump wagon, you know, it had the smaller wheels in front so they could turn right around and under it, you know, and the big wheels in back. And my father-in-law had moved down in the village, and his lawn wasn't too good, and so we're going to get some of this muck out of the muck bed there to put on the lawn to kind of fertilize it up, you know, make it better. I was back there in the muck bed getting a load of muck, and I'd drawed out two or three loads. And back in there, and I got a load on, and I happened to look, and boy, that thing sat right down in the muck there, you know. I spoke to the horses, and gee, they couldn't stir it. Well, I says to myself, I'm not going to dump that. I said, I'll go and get another team to hook on the front, draw it out. Well, we was back from the road, quite a little ways back from the road, as far as from here back to that big tree anyway. So I laid the lines over the seat and just let them hang there. And I walked over and They had the bars in there. It was back in the cow pasture, see where this muck bed was. And I started crawling over the bars, and I heard a noise, and I looked up, and there come that little pair of horses drawing that load of muck. You know what I done? I stood right there and I cried. I couldn't help it. And by gee, when I think of it yet today, I darn near cried. You see them little pair of horses? They wasn't going to leave me back on that load of muck.
Yeah,
and by gee, they come out there with it.
Hmm.
And I used to draw ice in the wintertime. The first load in the morning, somebody had to stand right to their heads all the while. I fed them good, you know, and the oats would prick them a little bit if they tell about it. They'd just stand right there and just dance every minute till I got that load of ice loaded. And when I got that load of ice loaded and I picked up the loins and I told the fellow, all right, and he'd get out away from the front of them. Now, I'm telling you, we started for the milk station, the ice house. They was always just like that. They was, I fed them good, and boy, they showed it. And I always kept a nice brass polished harness with the white rings on them, you know. And I always kept them dolled up.
How long did you have them?
Oh,
now, they appreciated that. They appreciated that pretty
yeah.
hard.
Yeah.
They act different. They step different.
Yeah.
You
next
know,
to dogs, horses are.
You know, it could be. That's the trouble with my horses here.
I
we just
about
got the most
years,
commonest old gear to put on them. We don't have anything where they'd feel dressed up, Mr. Eastman.
The first year that I had them, my father-in-law traded and got them. And I was working for him on the farm there the first year that I was married. He traded and got that little pair of Morgans. Well, we had another mare there, two had a third horse. Well, we were filling silo. And I had a sick spell there and couldn't go and drive them. My father-in-law drove them. Got over there to fill silo and somebody had to hold them every minute while they was unloading the corn, you know. They had that one of them there was a little bit more nervous than the other one. And boy, he just wouldn't stand. So my father-in-law, while I was sick, he took and drove the one Morgan and the other mare, see, over. He put them together and drove them over there, filling silo. Well, I got better, and I drove the Morgans to the milk station in the morning with the milk, and when I come back, I didn't swap horses. I drove the Morgans right along over to fill silo. Well, I got over there, and my father-in-law was pretty mad about it, and the fellow that owned the insulate cutter, he was sore too. I said, Billy's going to draw corn today, or he's going to dry right in these tracks. I went out and got a load of corn, and I pulled up the insulate cutter, and I stood off there side the horses, and I said to the fellow, all right, start her up. Well, he said, you got to get somebody here to hold that damn horse. I said, no, you haven't. I'll take care of that horse. I stepped over there to the fence right there. And they had a lot of, they used to take these hop poles, you know, that'd be about that big around. And they'd drive them right along in the fence to keep the cows from stretching the wires apart, see, to crawl through. I picked up one of them there that was about that long that had been used. I stepped upside to the team there, and he started up, and see that horse, he started right in a-dancing. I grabbed him by the bridle, and I says, you stand still there, or I'm going to kill you sure in the devil. And I swung that right around right over his head a couple of times like that, and I come right down right across his ribs. Well, I broke six of them darn nice white rings, but it didn't make any difference. And he stood right there, you know, and he started coming just like this. And Charlie said, well, what are you going to do now? I said, I'm going to unload that corn. I got right onto the wagon, and I unloaded the corn, and that horse stood right there, and you know, after that, he never would stir. You could drive up the instant cutter, and he'd stand there all day. He just got to have somebody tell him who was the boss.
Amen.
Well, what'd Charlie say?
And the Lord God gave us dominion over the beast.
That's what
you
got to do with them.
They need to be told now and again.
You know, back in them days, I got something else to tell you. They used to call me an expert horseman. Well, I'll tell you how expert horseman I was. We down another neighbor was cutting some wood on a side hill, and it was quite steep, drawing up out. Well, he had two pair of horses.
Yeah.
And I was over there, and I was driving the good pair, drawing the wood up out, you know. It was so darn steep that, you take a log about that big around, and you cut it off 10, 12 feet long, and all a pair of horses could do to draw it up out of there. Well, his son was driving this other pair, and they was pretty mean, you know. Balking one thing to another, but the son got along with them pretty good, so they give me the good pair to drive. Well, I'd been up and I'd come along back down, and gee, this one horse had balked, and there she stood with her head right around over the other horse's back, you know. And I walked up and took her by the bridle there and pulled her head around and got her straightened up in the harness. And the fellow that owned them, he says, here, he says, we cut you one of them good sticks, he says. And they had a lot of little trees about that big around, you know, and I cut one of them off with an axe, and I had one about 8-10 feet long. It was about as big around as your finger on the end of it up there. Now, he says, when I tell him to go, he says, if she lays her head over that other horse's back, he says, you just whack her one. So, sure enough, she swung right straight around like that, you know, right around over. And here I was back here. Well, you know, I gave her one whack over the head, and she swung right around inside that other horse and come right back like that. And she come right back at me, you know, with her mouth wide open just like that, and her eyes sticking right out, and her ears right down next to her neck. Well, I started to run. They didn't call me a horseman after that. You see, the fella had no control over him at all, because she'd turned right in like that, see, and the lines was all tangled right up, and she could just come right in there like that, you see, and I started running, she right after me. She took that other horse and all, you know, and got to come right after me down there.
Well, now, that's what would happen if I got out there with horses. They'd light out after me, Mr. Eastman.
Well, I call that a good horseman. That's knowing to have sense enough when to run.
He says, I run.
That's a good horseman. He who fights and runs away.
But, you know, I've just been wondering how that fellow's coming up on that roof while I'm down here.
Mr. Eastman? Let me tell you, these fellas don't hear much. They don't learn much. They don't hear much that's of any interest.
Yeah.
Now, you've told this several times, and I don't want to impose on you. But I think, you see, he can do anything. He can carpenter and electrical and...
You know, you hear a lot and you read a lot about strikes. Well, you know, they can't tell me nothing about strikes. Because I've been through 3 of them, and I know all about them. I helped organize the Dairy Farmers Union up there in New York State, and I was Madison County Chairman for 4 years. We went around putting on these meetings and everything. It wasn't nothing to talk to 5,000 or 6,000 people all at one time, you know. You get a good crowd to talk to, one thing and another. And after I got out of it, they wanted me to come back and supervise another strike. And I said, now listen, I've been through 3 of them, and we come out on top. Probably if I could start another one there, I might be on the bottom row. Well, they didn't like it, but I didn't get through with it. Sure, I put broadcasts on the radio. In the milk strike time.
What'd you say?
I sat right there, you know, and I had my script to read, and another fella sat right over there with a copy of it, and his finger right on the switch.
Oh!
They was afraid that I was going to say something that wasn't in the script, and they were going to cut me off.
How long ago was that?
Oh, that was back in 1936, 37. That was 37.
Pre-NRLB and so forth.
I don't believe there's been another time like the 30s, Mr.
No.
Eastman. Everything seemed to happen in the 30s. Let me see.
I went up one time to Milk Strike. They put on a meeting up in Pulaski, New York. That is, about 100 and some miles from where I live. And they had the meeting up there in the county courthouse, and geez, they were crowded in there. There wasn't hardly standing room. Well, I was a little bit late getting up there, and the chairman of the meeting there kept saying, he says, well, the state organization, he said, guaranteed to send us a speaker for tonight, but he says he hadn't showed up. He says, I don't know what we're going to do. Well, I let him go for two or three times of talking like that, and finally I walked up front. I said, well, now, Mr. Chairman, I think maybe I'm the man that you're looking for. And I introduced myself to him. So then he introduced me to the people. Well, at the end of the meeting there, I asked for pickets to go out on the picket line the next day. And you know, there was about 25 of them Polish women come up there and volunteered, and they told me afterwards that they were the meanest, most disagreeable people that they ever had on a picket line.
Well, that's what you want for pickets. That's what you want.
In the next county to me, the county chairman there was a Polish fella, and he was pretty radical. And when the milk strike came on, I had to run two counties. I had to keep him down, because, boy, I'm telling you, he was right out there, and they're going to kill this one and that and the other one, and somebody had to get him by the neck, you know, and hold him down. So I had two jobs when the milk strike was on. I had to run my own county and go over there and keep him quieted down.
Zeman, what did you tell him that night? What did you tell him that night when you walked up there and told him that you thought maybe you was the man he was waiting for? What did you say to him that night?
What did I say to him? Oh, I don't remember everything that I said, but I know that I had just put on the broadcast from Syracuse, and I didn't get all of my script, quite all of it, read to him when they cut me off, for the time was up. And so I finished reading that to him, one thing and another there, and talked to him.
Did you pay for that broadcast?
I didn't, the state organization did.
But you had to pay for it. I'm surprised they let you do it.
I know what it cost. It cost $500 a broadcast.
Gee whiz. On just a little old radio.
Yeah, well, and they were probably trying to discourage it. Radio, remember, was run by the management, too.
Is that right?
Sure. Still is.
Is that right?
The media, that was the reason they sat right there with the finger right on the switch. The media
cut me off, see, if I...
Establishment.
Yeah.
You know, I'm surprised. I'm surprised you got away with it at all, but that may have been on account of Roosevelt.
Did Roosevelt help you any?
Not too much.
Well, he was a liberal, and might not have even gotten on the thing in Hoover's day.
You might not have got on it back in Hoover's time.
Yeah.
But once or twice they had you on the run. The law was after you.
Yeah, they had me there one time. You know, I was a maintenance man for the milk stations up there, and they found out in the city there that I was a head one of the strike.
Yeah.
Ah!
Well, they had about 75 rolls of paper roofing up there to put on the roof up there at the milk station. So they got another fella to come in there with some other fellas to put that roofing on, see. So we was uptown there, and I says, Mikhail would come down off in that roof in a hurry if somebody just called his wife and said we was going to blow that milk station up.
Uh-oh.
I was just a fooling, you know. I'll be son of a gun. Somebody called her up and told her that. Well, you know, inside of about an hour, there were 12 truckloads of troopers, state troopers, went tearing up through there. There were four troopers in a car. They had them open cars, you know, and there were four troopers in the car, and they went tearing up by. Well, I said, Jesus, I said to myself, now that's going to spell trouble. Well, there was probably 25 or 30 fellas there to my place, there in the village, there's waiting for instructions on what to do the next morning on picket duty at some other milk station. Well, I didn't say anything to them where I was going, but I went right down in my cellar. He'll show you what a coward I was. Down there in that cellar, you know what apple barrels are? Well, they're a little smaller than a sugar barrel, you know. The sugar barrel is quite a little bit bigger. Well, there was probably close to 100 of them apple barrels down there, and once in a while around in them, there was a sugar barrel. And some of them was right side up and some was wrong side up. Well, I went right over there and I took that darn sugar barrel and I raised it right up, you know. And I just sat right down, just like this, and left that sugar barrel right down over the top of my head. Well, I sat right in there. And there was about a dozen of them troopers come down in there and they were looking all over for me and they couldn't find me. They come down there in the cellar and all, and they looked around the barrels and one thing and another, and geez, they didn't get over as far as where I was. Finally said, well, I guess he ain't down in here, but I said, it's darn funny. His truck is out here and his car is here. He must have gone with somebody else. And they went out, and my wife was out there talking to the pickets, and they were going to pinch her and take her in until they could get a hold of me. And when anything like that comes up, and if the newspapers hear about it, you know, there's a reporter right there in a minute. Well, this Johnny Fagg, he was a reporter for the Syracuse Herald, and my wife used to write the news for the Herald from the village there. And Johnny was up there, he was looking around to get the news on it, and so they was going to take her in, and Johnny Fagg said, well, I said, don't take her in. He says, she's out here getting the news just the same as I am, because he says she writes for our paper. So then they let her go. That meant for Johnny Fagg that it took her down. They didn't find me.
They didn't come back after you.
They never did get a hold of you. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you, Mrs. Eastman, now I think after this, you got to tell them about that lady up there where you were putting in the glass, plate glass doors, and sprucing it up. Now this is rich. Against this background.
Well, I've already learned an awful lot. He's going to be charging us before long. I've learned not to take part in any kind of faulty raw without having apple and sugar barrels in the basement.
I'll tell you what he's talking about. Down here at Orange Lake, I belong to the civic club down there 13 years. And after 10 years, I was vice president of it. Well, they're going to have an election of officers, and I was due for be elected president down there. Well, my sister-in-law, I done quite a lot of work on their house down there last summer, getting it all fixed up and one thing and another. And we built on a kitchen, and then I built on the enclosed porch on there. And I put these glass sliding doors between the porch and the living room there, and we put the wall-to-wall carpet in there, you know, and I had to set the door in just a little bit so that it would cover the seam in the carpet between the porch and the front room. I got it all fixed up. It's pretty nice. Well, all this time that I was fixing them up, for his brother was coming down from Michigan, see, to visit them down there, and they wanted everything right in top-notch order for this brother to see. Well, all the time that I was doing that work over there, she was nice to me, to my face, you know. But this telephone man, they moved a trailer in on their property there to set there. And the minute that he moved in there with that trailer, why, she thought that he was God Almighty or somebody, you know. And that nobody liked Larry. Well, I never give it a thought that he would be coming over there to the club, you know. But she run him over there to the club that night. Well, I'll tell you a little bit more than that. We put on potluck suppers down there. And I always made the coffee, and I was always one of the head ones of the potluck supper, see. Well, gee, she come right in there, you know, and we got all ready to eat, and she jumps right up and invites Larry to say grace for the supper.
Yeah.
Well, gee, you know, there was a whole bunch of us that belonged to the club that was just as able to say grace as he was. And she was pushing him in there, see? Well, I didn't think too much about it. Well, the night they were going to have the election of officers there, she come and got him to join the club before the meeting, see? And signed him up in there to join the club before the meeting, see? Well, come to find out that she and him had been all around, you know, and getting the members of the club to vote against me, to vote for him for the president of the club. So when they come around by there, he beat me out by one vote.
Yeah.
So I said that the club could take their business and stick it. I was all done. So they wanted me to take treasure and all, geez, all a lot of other stuff. I had nothing doing. I didn't want nothing to do with it at all. I said, I'm all caught up with the club and with you. I went back home and I wrote her a letter and told her what I thought of her, and I said, all that I ask of you is a check for the bill that I'm enclosing for the work that I've done. Well,
see,
if she went around telling that,
yes, that's it,
that I was an old fossil and I'd run the club in an old-fashioned way, and she wanted somebody young in there to run it that would get things done and get more new members. Well, he hasn't got one blessed new member since he's been in there. And the other night, they put on a meeting down there for this Berenson to come up and talk to the community about what a great thing this High Life was going to be for the county. And there were six people showed up. There was a telephone man and his wife, my brother-in-law and my sister-in-law, and the runner and his wife down there. There were six of them showed up to hear this fellow tell what a wonderful thing this High Life was going to be. Now that's the way that came out.
But you see, now the thing is, with all this stuff, you know, he's been talking about, she goes around while he's sprucing up the house and tells him all he's an old fossil. He's an old fossil. He won't get nothing done.
So she didn't pay me in January, so the 1st of February, I sent her another bill, a copy of what I've got out there and that I keep out in the truck that I used to use up home when my collections got kind of hard, you know. I tell him that I'd waited longer than my creditors waited for me, and it was time for them to pay, and one thing and another, and I'd appreciate it. I signed it down at the bottom of the old fossil. You know, in a couple of days, I got my checks. So now I'll take another glass of water, and I'll go back on the roof.
Who's up
the old fossil got a check from the old bitch. Well, beautiful.
Isn't that something?
Beautiful.
Yeah.
How about
that? So I've seen a lot of the hard knocks of life.
Forget the little girl with a religion problem. Get him to write some of this down.
Let me tell you, Mr. Eastman, you have
language. The language is beautiful. I hear all those old words like drawing. People say drive, but drawing.
You think he's out of the running and all like that? Why, you know, he got it down there. He got more. It's just like going to the picture show every day.
Better.
He goes down there at them trailer camps and the restaurants and all like that.
Better. If not, it's real.
And the cooks know him, and the head man knows him. How's old Clyde?
Huh?
Is Clyde straightened out?
Is what?
Clyde, somebody else.
Oh, you know, over there at the trade wind.
Barnard?
Barnard's the helper. Whatever happened to him?
Well, I don't know. He ain't there.
Oh, he ain't there.
Uh-oh. He's gone somewhere. You know, there's a funny thing. That fellow worked there, and he is extra good kitchen help. Now, I'll give him credit for that. But, you know, he went and got a lot of dope from somewhere, and then he got a little liquor onto it, and it just made him crazy. Well, he come in there one night, and he used to take the truck, and he'd take the colored help home, see, and get the other ones when they change shifts.
Yeah.
Well, he went down with one colored woman there, and gee, he didn't come back. And they went looking him up, and they couldn't find him. Well, when he did come back, He was pretty tottery around there, you know. So Bernard told him, he said, George.
George.
He said, you've been drinking. He said, now you go down and go to bed and stay there. George looked up. There wasn't no son of a gun ever going to tell him what to do. And he went tearing out of there, you know, and they thought he'd gone down to go to bed. And he said that. He went down and got a rifle and a big hunting knife and come back. He was going to butcher Barnard. Well, they had quite a set-to in there and trying to get the gun away from him, one thing and another. One fella got his ribs broke. And this fella, they finally got the knife away from him there, and he got a hold of Barnard. And they had this jalousie door there, and he started to throw Barnard right through the door, and Barnard hung on to him, and they both went through it. They broke seven of them jalousies right out of the door. So they called up, and I had to go over and get a piece of plywood and nail on the inside and fix it up. That's on Sunday, so because they couldn't get no glass Sunday night there, and so fixed it up with the plywood there till the next morning. And the troopers come up, the sheriff's department come up, and there were two fellows, and they couldn't find him, so they called back in, and two more come. Well, then they couldn't find him, so they made up their mind that he went either north or south, the other highway. So one car went north, and the other one went south. Well, they had known just nicely got gone when George appeared. Well, another fellow and I got a hold of George, and we was trying to hold him there. And I said to this other fellow, I said, well, you kind of keep him right here, and I'll go and call the sheriff again. So I went down to call the sheriff again, and just as I got into the restaurant, the one car come, and I told him, I said, he's over there. This other fellow holding him over there in the ditch over across the road. So they started right over there, and then the other car come. He put in a call right there for the other car, and the other car come. And you know, it took the five of them, the fellow that was holding him, and the four deputy sheriffs to get that fellow in the car. And I swore to goodness that he was going to get away from them. By gee, he got right down, he got right in under the car. He got that much away from them. He was one of the most wary fellows that you ever see.
I reckon.
And you thought he's just a wreck of a fellow over there.
Yeah.
Wasn't hardly able to totter around, didn't
you? Yeah. But boy, now, they couldn't handle him.
Well, it's astonishing how what you can do when you're motivated about getting away from the law.
Yeah. And I could hear him hollering and swearing at him over there, boy.
Oh, is that right?
But he had a choice word.
Mr. Eastman, let me tell you. They passed a law, or at least they had a law up before the legislature this time, saying that you couldn't insult the law when they was acting in their legal capacity. You can't insult a policeman or a trooper or anybody who comes out there to arrest you.
Yeah.
Now, ain't that something?
Yeah.
You can't say nothing that's insulting to them.
Yeah.
You got to say, sir.
Yeah, well, he said plenty.
That's better than sir. Plenty is better than sir.
But here's the funny part of it. They had him in jail down there, I don't know, two or three weeks. And they was going to have his trial come up, and they had a hearing down there. And you know, Barnard went down and bailed him out and got him out and got his driver's license back and everything to get him to come back into the restaurant.
Well, you started this whole thing out by saying he was good kitchen help. He must have been.
Yeah.
In fact, he wanted him back that bad. Must have been worth it.
But I don't think he's ever any good anymore.
Well, then all at once he disappeared and nobody knew where he was. And he was gone a couple of weeks. All at once one night they got a telephone call from Chicago. Wanted the restaurant to send him $25 so that he could get back down here to work. And they told him they wouldn't send him any money. Well, I don't know where he got it, but he got back. He came back down here and worked, oh, I guess a month. Now he's gone again. They don't know where he is.
Now you see him, now you don't.
Yeah, I'll tell you. Now let me tell you.